Welcome to SRG Offscript, the podcast where experts at Succession Resource Group unpack the latest industry trends, recommendations, and observations for independent advisors managing their practice. With no fluff and a little entertainment. In each episode, we'll discuss ways in which you can understand and leverage the value of your business, grow your business through M&A, but also through an optimized organizational structure, improve and protect your business to create a sustainable enterprise that can hopefully outlast you, and lastly, preparing for your eventual retirement and how to maximize that result. So, we encourage you to listen in with whatever beverage suits your preference, and let's get to the forefront of industry trends with a fresh perspective to help you achieve your business goals. And welcome back to another episode of SRG Offscript. Happy to have with me today Ray Sclafani from ClientWise, somebody who I have known, admired, followed, had lots of shared clients with over the last 20 years I've been doing this, but last 10 years under the SRG banner. Ray is somebody who, when you get folks that you're consulting with, you've got coaches involved. Most of the time, coaches, the consultants, by no means just Ray, he's got an amazing team there, but anybody on the ClientWise side, when any of our consultants get on the phone, they know they've got a ClientWise client, our shared clients on the phone. It's always just such a joy and pleasure to have them on, because without even intentionally doing it, we seem to read from the same script a lot, have the same outlook in many perspectives on trends for the industry, training up Gen 2, Gen 3 folks, building scalable practices. So anyway, I was able to actually get the man himself to join me here today. So I want to take a moment and say thanks for joining us. You want to give maybe everybody a little bit of background on, the few that don't know who you are, you, ClientWise, your amazing team there?
The sure thing. And it's an honor to be here, David. I've admired you and the work that you've done over the past couple of decades, and certainly with SRG as well. Exciting to be here. ClientWise, I'll give you the short skinny, was founded 18 years ago. I am the founder of the company. I lead a team today. We've got 27 coaches and growing. We intend to add more this year. We also have a core team of about 15 folks and some other independent contractors that do some marketing and writing for us. So all in, we've got 45, 50 folks, and we're continuing to grow. We are in the middle of a 10x ramp up. We've got a five-year strategy to do that. And we're very excited about the work we're doing and helping advisors build enduring firms. It's a term I think Mark Tabergian coined many years ago and has written a number of books about that. We actually believe strongly in the nobility of the work that the advisors do, and the best in the business want to make a difference not only with the current client, but they want a ripple effect multi-generationally. And the only way to do that is to build an enduring firm. And so when I set up the company 18 years ago, the intent was to help advisors grow enterprise value, to grow the value they're providing clients, to provide that value multi-generationally. And that's been an exciting ride and a lot of growth over the past almost two decades.
Yeah, and it's been a joy and pleasure to watch you guys and the work that you do. I feel like, and this could just be me, but even when I think of the term coach, I feel like it almost diminishes the impact you all have on your clients and the work that you do, your thought leadership. I feel like sometimes when people think about a coach, they think about somebody who helps hold them accountable. I'm sure you guys do that too, but I mean, you guys are a lot more prescriptive and hands-on than I think what people might think of as the typical coach. Is that fair, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think that's right. We do coaching and we do consulting and we do what we call at ClientWise some coachulting, which is a little bit of both. Our clients are smart, successful entrepreneurs that are owners of great wealth advising businesses, and they're ambitious and see a brighter future and a multi-generational impact. And they recognize that they're looking for leadership development. They're looking for next generation development, but they're also looking to understand, how do I structure my P&L? What does a good chart of accounts look like? And what are some benchmarks for revenue per professional or revenue per client? How do I compensate team members? Yeah, Dave, David, that's exactly right. We're wanting to help clients in a multitude of ways, but the difference at ClientWise, I think, at least I hear from clients consistently, is it's about the community, the thousands of professionals in the community that are also supporting one another. So we have a great coaching professional staff of coaches that are all master certified and professional certified with the International Coach Federation. I'll come back to that in a minute. But we also have a really great group of clients willing to help one another. I mean, I watched over the holiday break, the number of advisors that were sharing year-end bonus strategies and their 2024 goals and how they were doing client reviews. It was just so impressive to see what they were sharing with one another. And as an organization, we are always studying what are the best in the business doing. And the best ideas actually come from our clients watching what's working and then helping others to replicate that. I think of coaching, the word coach is such a dangerous word. Everybody, I'm a coach, you're a coach, he's a coach, right. Wouldn't you want to be a coach too? I liken it to the way an advisor explained it to me, David. It was like the way many financial planners in our industry call themselves planners, but not as many have gone through the rigorous education and testing to become certified financial planners, or with the Investment and Wealth Institute, the Chartered Private Wealth Advisor. When you go through that education, that training, and you understand core competencies, the technical prowess that's required, the ethical standards, you level up as a planner. In coaching, it's exactly the same. There are a whole lot of people out there that call themselves coaches, but not as many have gone through the rigorous training and education or stand by a code of ethics and use a set of competencies that are really tailored for the profession of coaching. So to answer your question, yes, at ClientWise, our clients, advisors, and their teams find lots of research, guidelines, guidebooks, articles, benchmarks, compensation design, even some valuation suggestions and work. But we also do that coaching as well.
We have worked so well without even trying as organizations, ClientWise and SRG, because you guys do so much work in thought leadership around building that enduring enterprise, which is the same thing that we do, just again, from different angles, different perspectives, but you guys lead them effectively right up to our doorstep in what we do, which is very tactical, very hands-on. It's not talking about succession or why you should or shouldn't. That you guys are amazing at, but as soon as they have committed to that path, then we can do the work that we do, go away. That's a real challenge for a lot of our other non-ClientWise coached clients, because while our succession planning work or merger and acquisition work may start and stop with the spreadsheets and the contracts and the whole transition plan, I mean, we try to take it end to end, but our end to end, it isn't actually the end of the journey. And so they finish us or the work with us around building their succession plan, as an example, or their merger. And frankly, then you and I both know, then the real work begins.
That's when it begins. That's right.
That's when it begins. And that's the stuff we exit stage left. Our work is done. The plan is created. But that's where you guys can then, I think, pick the ball up and really help them be successful with it. And it's been kind of cool to watch that happen organically. And so I do look forward to us being able to be more intentional about that. But what are your thoughts? I know I'm kind of going off script here, but as you think about all the things that go into mergers and acquisitions and succession planning, I know we have two different lenses, but you and I both know that is where the real work begins. Like, how do people be successful with succession planning after we've done the spreadsheets and the modeling? We've got Gen 2 and Gen 3 lined up. I mean, it's not easy to take 10, 20, 30 years worth of knowledge, clients, and get that next generation prepared, ready, viewed as a peer and not a subordinate. I mean, where do you guys even start with something like that? Just, it seems like such a daunting task.
Yeah, it's an exciting body of, and every firm and its leaders are very different. We have actually promoted from the day I founded ClientWise the importance of building next generation leadership. That, in fact, there's an advisor, he said it to me best. He said, "Ray, we're not in wealth management. We're actually in the human capital business that delivers wealth management." And I thought that quote really exemplifies what the best in the business really are doing, which is developing people. Jack Welch had a great quote, David. He said, "The sign of a great leader is somebody who can develop somebody who can develop somebody." And at ClientWise, we're focused on developing people. And oh, by the way, if you develop great people with great skill around understanding how to run an entrepreneurial wealth advising business, magic happens. It's like their eyes open up and they see the possibility of not only their impact. I oftentimes think of, you got to think about the heartstrings, the impact work, the purposeful, intentional work, and being wealth advisor is so powerful. you change lives forever. And I've been a witness to that in the 30 years plus I've been in the business, watching great professionals make a difference. It's really remarkable. And the best tell me that's why they're in the business. But then there's the purse strings. If you do it right, if you set it up right, the value of these businesses continues to expand and grow. And truth be told, I don't know what multiples will look like in 5 and 7 and 10 years, just like 15 years ago, I didn't know where we would be today. But the sign of a good business where you're dropping that 30% to the bottom line, where the founder or controlling owner or owners haven't become not helpful anymore. They just have become less important to the day-to-day, and they've transitioned responsibility. We have a program we internally at ClientWise call our step-down, step-up plan. And it's every leader needs to be thinking, like, what are the responsibilities that you need to step down from, and to whom do you plan on educating, training, developing, inviting to step up to take over some of those responsibilities? That if you build it right, endurance is all about the cyclical nature. And then, oh, by the way, you got to do that with the clients. And it's a very exciting work. It keeps me more motivated and more excited today than I think I've ever been, helping advisors and lead a business that's helping advisors do that. We're trying to do it ourselves at ClientWise. We're in the middle of that process ourselves.
Well, I'm going to make sure I follow up with you after our session here today, which I would have done anyway. But specifically, in our succession planning process, one of the steps beyond the spreadsheets and the contracts, which we love, we know their importance, but it's the role transition planner. And it's the more practical aspect and element of, okay, well, we've got 10 years or 7 years before the founder wants to be able to exit stage left, or at least be in a position where he or she could without impacting the business anymore.
Sure.
We start trying to identify what are the 30 balls that you're responsible for juggling, some of which you probably don't even realize that you have, but they're on your plate. How do we get those transitioned over? When do we do it? How do we do it? Who do we transition it to? But I imagine that, frankly, would be a really good handoff opportunity for folks who already are not working with you that probably should be, because our role transition planners are, it's a really good way for them to get the juices flowing. But you can see a lot of times where eventually with enough coaching and consulting, the spreadsheets and the contracts all make sense. I feel like that role transition planner and mapping out hypothetical handoff of roles and duties over the next 5 or 10 years, we just get the deer in the headlights look a lot of times.
Right. Most advisors, David, they'll tell you they don't get in the business to manage a big team. But the unintentional consequence of being really good at making a difference is you end up with a lot of clients and you need a team. And then at some point, most advisors wake up and they look at around and they go, wow, we've been really successful. I'm an unintentional owner.
Right.
Now what? Yeah. So that transition thing's a big deal. It sort of breaks down into a few parts that are pretty easy to document, whether it's the human capital piece, the hiring, training, developing, promoting, giving feedback, the developing of people piece. It's the, believe it or not, the technology decisions, the compliance decisions. It's also the operations decisions and the financial management. Then you've got all the client work, right? And then you've got the strategy and vision, mission, values of the firm. So if you put all these pieces together, it takes a minimum of 5 to 7 years to effectively transition a firm. Now, we've helped firms transition in shorter order than that due to terminal illness or disability that occurred, unfortunately, a death of a partner. So we've seen all of that movie, all those movies. But if you can do it orderly, it's a minimum of 5 to 7 years of training and developing and transitioning. But then it also, what I've learned along the way, it takes typically for a really good business, typically 2 to 3 to replace a controlling owner or founder, right? What often happens is that controlling owner founder can either be a controlling owner founder that just fell into a lot of that work, or they happen to be a controlling owner. Like they held on to, there's a great quote in a book I read a couple of years ago. And the quote was, everything I ever let go of has claw marks on it. You might have a controlling owner that doesn't necessarily want to let go. So we're coaching advisors to figure out, where do they sit in the continuum? What's their time to exit? What is their step down plan? To whom do they want to step up? And what is the financial model? This is where I think you guys do such a fabulous job in the work you do. What does that financial model look like so that when advisors begin to dilute their equity position, that they dilute that equity position, they might own fewer shares, but the value of the shares are growing and they're reaching their own financial reward and return on investment. Because a lot of the investment most advisors have made in these businesses is sweat equity. And
right.
You got to introduce the passage to partnership early. You've got to be, most advisors need to be really clear and transparent about what that looks like so they don't end up with a team that's sort of begging for them to leave and yet they've not reached their financial goals. So I see a lot of strange cases where advisors aren't clear enough. They're not explicit enough. You talk about succession. When we run our Success and Succession program, the one thing that I've learned out of that program, having coached hundreds of advisors through that program, is there are explicit promises and implicit promises. And it's the implicit promises that get those advisors in trouble. And you got to make the implicit explicit so the transition plan happens right. But even beyond just transition, just running a great firm requires, as you grow, a lot more documentation and a lot more communication and doing that sequentially so the founder controlling owner ends up with the team and the business that they really, really want.
Well, it's funny to hear you mention that because a lot of business owners that I have seen be successful that have well-oiled teams, everyone works together, they're outgoing, they're gregarious, they have passion for what they do, but they're also, to some degree, they're kind of people pleasers. They want to make those around them successful and happy. And unfortunately, sometimes that leads to some implicit promises that you maybe didn't intend it to come across that way, but it does. And when it comes to compensation, equity, role development, and planning, you got to be really explicit with that stuff and as intentional as possible. And I've been guilty of that professionally, personally with my kids. I constantly, like, I don't remember promising that. Well, implicitly, you could see how they got there. So I love that you point that out and the difference between the two because they're both equally relevant. You also mentioned the 2-3 ratio, that 2-3 next gen advisors for every founder. We've seen the exact same thing. I mean, frankly, for some of them, it could be as much as 3 or 4. I feel like a lot of that comes from, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. A lot of it comes from, it's that old saying, you know, what got you here won't get you there. We've got so many folks who started the business. They started from nothing or they started at a wirehouse, built a book, went independent, started their quote unquote business. They were very successful, built the book up over time, and they need skills early on in terms of prospecting and then figuring out technology stacks and figuring out how to get the phone system to work and then how to figure out the insurance for the employees that you just hired. Well, I hired employees. Now we got to figure out a career track. You get founders who are really good at a whole bunch of things, but they're not great at one or two of them. And I feel that's where a lot of that ratio of 2-3 next gen advisors comes in, where you got the business to 2 or 3 million in revenue or 3 or 5 million in revenue, but to go from 5 to 10, we don't need quite that same entrepreneurial mindset. We need somebody with a more narrow body of skills. Have you seen something similar, different? I know you're very hands-on with your guys' clients.
Yeah, I am. And obviously we've got a team of coaches that are doing that. And we check in with each other as a coaching team regularly. So we're hearing very consistent patterns and themes that emerge. I would say for those listening who are in an advisor seat as a controlling owner or founder, that the next 5 to 7 years should be the most joyful, the most exciting and exhilarating and freeing that you've ever had. And for businesses that are in high growth mode and you've got a bright future, you got to create a space where the work is fun and it's joyful. And you've got to pick out the parts of the business that bring you great joy. Most advisors would say choosing a health care plan doesn't bring them great joy, right? But yet there's HR professionals who like love doing that stuff. Most advisors would say, man, I don't want to build a client review process or a client onboarding process. That just doesn't excite me. I'm like, okay, right. Good. Don't do it, right? You got to start thinking about how to use the capital that you've earned and you've generated as profits to redeploy into professional staff, professional management. And so I think what you're describing, David, is exactly right. You got to start getting people in their lanes who really love parts of the business. Now, the tricky part is this, that there's, I think somebody at Schwab once said, it's the valley of doom. There's this period of time where you almost have to take 5 steps back to take seven forward. And it's that period of time where most advisors experience at about $500 million in assets, maybe $5 million or so in revenue, that there's this feeling that they've made it. Cash flow's good. Profits look good. You're at Vista and you're looking out and you now see another higher mountain and you're like, whoa, we're going to get there sooner than I think. And if you don't invest in the human capital piece, if you don't get that professionalization of the firm down, what got you to the 500 million isn't going to get you to the billion. And then advisors will look at me and say, well, Ray, I don't necessarily want to get there. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good right here, which is fine. But if you're good at what you do, like it or not, the business is going to grow.
Yep.
The unintended consequence of doing a great job, 92% of net new flows come in vis-a-vis some introduction from another professional, a center of influence, or from a client. And so at the end of the day, what I would encourage advisors, anybody to do, start figuring out how you can get to a place where 80 to 90% of the time you spend in the workplace is joyful work. For some, it's, hey, I love running portfolios. For others, it's, I love the technical side of helping clients mitigate taxes and building great estate planning structures. For others, it's, I love meeting with clients. And then for others, it's, how do I become a great CEO?
Yeah.
And each of these roles are very different. So as you hit that $5 million mark, you got to stop thinking like I've got to wear all the hats and you got to start sharing the hats. But make sure you pick the hat that you enjoy the most to wear so that it gets even more exciting in the years ahead.
And I'm curious your thoughts, Ray. So as you talk about, you know, the importance of finding maybe not the one or two, but the core parts of the job that bring you joy, specializing in that, and then bringing people around you to be experts in the other things. I have seen folks be, I'll put air quotes around it, successful in building out $10, $20 million enterprises, but they do it by virtue of creating little carbon copies of themselves. And I don't mean little as in like belittling them, but they have had a ton of success. They've gotten to $2 or $3 million in revenue, and then they bring on another advisor under them and they push some clients down. They give them a payout. That person's responsible for building their book and they leave them alone. And if they're successful, great. If they're not, then they'll move on and find something else or just sort of stay here in some mid-tier production role and be okay. But they'll continue to do that. And they almost build these kind of mini broker dealers, if you will, where yeah. You've got this hub and spoke model, and they'll say, well, I've been able to get around that without actually having to mentor and train and do all this stuff. But that, to me, not to put labels on things, but anybody who says that's about to put a label on it, that silo versus ensemble structure, I wouldn't label them good or bad, but from a valuation perspective, I can and I will. The siloed model, it doesn't have the same enterprise value, isn't as scalable, it's not as sustainable. And for that reason, we end up leaning a lot more into that ensemble structure, but it's a lot of work to get there. Your thoughts, do you have clients setting up and running businesses on both sides of the spectrum, one versus the other?
We do. We don't. Okay. We do not have a perfect model like, oh man, you come to ClientWise, go build it this way. There are plenty of, I'm going to air quote, coaching organizations or consulting organizations out there that'll tell you how to run a business the way they built the business.
Right.
We actually enjoy helping advisors build the business they want to build, and more importantly, build a business that they want their next generation to want to own. There's something to be said for this idea, depending upon where you are in your career, you know, what you want as an outcome, what you want as an outcome in terms of the role you want to play, your transition, the financial reward and impact. And it's fair to say there are a number of great producer groups out there. I think you called it a silo, a siloed structure, a siloed ensemble. I think synonymously, I would use the term producer group. Those producer groups are okay. I mean, they're good sort of test and learn for some folks. I mean, let's think about it. The divorce rate among teams in the U.S. is worse than the divorce rate of marriages in the U.S. It peaks over 54%. And in fact, when we have a program called Merger Maximizer. So advisors thinking about merging their businesses together, there's a 12 to 16 week coaching program that they run through. And there's a lot of pre-work and work with a coach, and they do work after on their own with their potential partner. 63% of those teams end up merging. And somewhere along the way, the other third decide that they're not a fit. 37% decide they're not a fit. And we think it's fine to build a producer group so long as there's some intent. You don't maximize enterprise value. Right. That's really clear. And it also creates lots of double time inside these teams. Jane, she likes running her financial plans one way. John likes running his financial plans another way. And the founder, Mike, likes running his plans right up until the client's walking in the front door. And poor Mike and Joan, who are building the financial plans, are panicked trying to figure out how to support three different models with three different timelines. And the founder, he's always going to get what he wants when he wants it. So everybody else suffered. I mean, the whole thing doesn't work long term. Again, nice structure. But let me be clear. Some of those, David, I see happening in the marketplace is this. I liken it to like 1845 in the United States, when wagons headed west in horse and buggy with loads of barbed wire, and it was all about staking ground. And as much land as you could stake out and protect, the better off you'd be. I do think that there are a number of serial aggregators in the U.S. that are not thinking about building an ensemble, but they're thinking about building as big a book of clients and assets as they can get to attract as much private equity money and flip the thing for as big a multiple as they can get as fast as they can get it. And let's face it, there is arbitrage to be played buying a $100, $200, $300 million book at 5, 7, 8 times EBITDA or 1 or 2 times GDC into a model trading at 14, 18, 22 times EBITDA. So I think there's just this weird thing happening in financial services right about now where there's just so much money flooding the marketplace that these producer groups are popping up left and right. And many of the firms aren't really thinking about strategy. They're not thinking about integration. Most importantly, they're not thinking about a unified client experience that's multi-generational. I think if you use the North Star as that, then the clients win. The business and its enterprise value wins, team members win, and there's a career path for the next generation to continue to serve and make an impact. That, to me, is what I see as the best in the business doing, to stand up something that's enduring that in that way.
Yeah, 100%. We end up seeing it, ferreting it out on occasion through the evaluation work that our teams will do before we get into any of the other work, and they start asking this $10 million team, tell us about your client onboarding experience. The first year as a new client, let's run through it. And they struggle to give the answer because there's a couple different versions of it depending on which partner you ask. And that a team does not make. I mean, that makes it really difficult to scale that, to train it, to mentor it, to build it into your workflows, the CRM system. And so you just never get the efficiencies. And I mean, to your point on the multiples, when you look at firms that are getting 10, 12, 14 times their earnings, it isn't because of their size. I mean, that's part of it for sure. But they get those high multiples because with that size, you're almost forced, not universally, but you're almost forced in most cases when you get to that size with billions of to have systems and processes and things are documented. You have a client onboarding experience. And it isn't 4 different versions from 4 different partners. It's the best of from all 4 partners. That's really cool to see. And then all of a sudden, you have something that it's scalable, it's transferable. It's also funny because those would be the practices, enterprises, frankly, they'll never hit the market. They'll never list and sell because they're going to be recycling their equity internally because Gen 1 is training and mentoring Gen 2 simultaneously is working with Gen 1 to train and prepare Gen 3. And you just end up on this cycle where the business, it'll never need to turn over. You get these founders who, if you're not careful, they're coming back at some point, age 70, 75, saying, retire from what? I love what I do. That one thing you talked about earlier, Ray, I do that one thing that I've always wanted to do, and that's all I do now. And you talk to Gen 2 and Gen 3, they've got the founder still on the website. It's great for client continuity. Everybody's happy. Gen 2, Gen 3 is taking over the part of the business that they're really good at. So it's really interesting to see these models come all together. But I do feel like it's, whether it's by design or by default, and you'll have more insight into this with all your coaches having their hands in so many practices, it seems like either by design or by default, we are seeing the industry shift from this generalist model to more specialist model. And when you get a whole team of specialists, some really cool stuff starts to happen. I think it'll be hard for the smaller generalist to compete with these growing teams that have experts. Like, all this person does all day long is financial plans, and they are amazing at it. They are fast, they are efficient. In the financial plan, because it's all that they do, it's all that they own, it looks so much better and it's so much more thorough than the generalist who's outsourcing it using the same service that 100 other advisors are using. Your thoughts on this kind of shift from a generalist to more of, like, we use the term farmers and hunters, but yeah, there's lots of different terms for it.
Yeah, there is. I just want to go back one quick moment. As you were describing sort of that producer group siloed ensemble piece and talking about valuations and what's going on, I think of it as quality of earnings. You know, that assessment of the earnings, removing any distortions. You run your P&L that way, I run it this way. Wait, you run the operation this way, I run it this way, but we house under the same umbrella. That quality of earnings really is diluted by the different types of businesses underneath an umbrella, but more to come on that later down the road. Let me get into that. This is an interesting, you bring up a really interesting point. I think there's been a number of research studies. I think Schwab, TD, before they merged with Schwab, Fidelity for sure. I was talking to Ben over at Pershing. I know they've done a lot of studying in this area, and this specialization is really the future. That this idea of being a generalist, it's just technically almost impossible today to have all of the skill set related to estate, the tax challenges and helping mitigate taxes, working with centers of influence, whether estate taxes professionals or accountants, but also understanding how to work with corporate executives with concentrated stock positions or entrepreneurs that own closely owned family businesses where there's no next generation to sell. I mean, it's just getting a lot more tricky to be that generalist. And in fact, I think the heightened view of generality is this registered investment advisor that just invests client assets and then maybe dabbles in some financial planning. I'm noticing some of the largest RIAs now in the United States, multi-billion dollar firms that really hung their hat on their investment prowess with some financial planning, maybe some estate and trust work, maybe partnering with a bank and a local CPA and a local estate attorney to build out some of those services, but they really hung their hat on pure investment management. Some of those firms we're noticing are really thinking more broadly about introducing new services, but doing so at a profitable way. And it depends what segment of the market you want to service. Some clients are looking for help with just running a cash flow statement or bill paying. Higher net worth clients are looking for a little more sophisticated level of service, whereas clients maybe who are mass affluent or affluent are just looking for confidence that they've got the right plan and they'll actually be distributing their income and they've got an income distribution strategy to do that in the most tax efficient way. All of those require a little more technical specialty, a little more intentionality, and yet the business still has to grow. The beauty as you expand and grow your number of advisors, those who are really helping to drive the success of the firm by bringing new clients, new revenues, new assets to the organization are the individuals who should be on a passage toward partnership, who should be viewed as those next generation professionals, as the majority owners. Doesn't mean that professional staff, CEO or CFO or a CMO or a COO wouldn't have some equity ownership, but that's a much bigger firm. In a typical $150 to billion dollar kind of firm, there's still lots of need to have the majority of the firm owned by those who are helping to grow the firm and who actually touch the clients and generate that income. Kind of like a law firm, by the way. You've got senior partners, equity partners, then you've got income partners, and each play an important role. The idea of the divisibility of that lead advisor role, we did a bunch of research years ago, about 3 years ago now at ClientWise. I kept hearing the term lead advisor. Obviously, it shows up in all the benchmarking studies with Investment News and with Schwab's study. The CFP board put together a fabulous piece around the career paths for CFP. And that's on their public website that's available for anybody's download. So some really good industry resources out there. And I kept seeing this lead advisor. But when we reached into the various firms and we saw what these teams were doing, lead advisors looked very different. That they all weren't rainmakers out looking in the jungle for new business. Yep. Some were actually really good working in the zoo, harvesting from the existing clients. I think you call those farmers.
Yeah, exactly.
But then there were some of these that were really great zookeepers. They were these relationship managers that didn't generate a whole lot of business, but man, they were rock solid at building relationship with the generation below and the generation above. And by building that multi-generational relationship, they were key influencers in identifying opportunities because they had such a strong relationship with the client. They weren't necessarily those individuals who were in the sales seat, so to speak, but they were able to generate a lead internally to another younger partner or a senior partner in the firm, depending upon the opportunity. So we're witnessing this, right? So we're studying this, and we decided to come out with this research paper for our clients, 4 levels of lead advisors. And there is indeed a level 1, 2, 3, and 4. 4 on the right side, if you're looking at a chart, they're doing the majority of the rainmaking for the firm, looking for new business. Whereas on the left side, that level 1 is somebody who is that relationship manager, that lead advisor level 1. And so as we watch this progression, some people decide to move up the ladder. Other people, in fact, I chatted with a young lady. She was, I think, 11 years in her role as a level 1 lead. She was a relationship manager, and she was killer. She was one of the most technically proficient, smart as a whip, great relationship builder, and an internal lead generator for the senior partners in the firm. And she didn't want to do any hunting in the jungle. But she was essential to the operation. So I think advisors, as they scale and grow, have to have an open mind to the various pathways that their current team, but also as they're hiring new team, can fall into. That the old days of everybody walks uphill to school in the snow, so therefore we should all cold call, we should all cold walk, you should build your own book inside here too. That's not what these mature businesses need. Sometimes they just need great relationship managers, and that's okay too, some of whom may turn into rainmakers down the road. So there's a lot to unpack there, but that's my take on what you described.
Well, and there's a whole nother podcast for the two of us just with that topic, frankly. Because yeah, I mean, I love your example of her being in that role for 11 years. I mean, she had to have been amazing at it at that point. And then you start thinking about, well, what most firms do, what most teams do. I was reading the Diamond Team model, came up again on another consulting call where their coach was talking to them about getting their version of that person to start spending more of their time on prospecting. I think, why? They're amazing at the client service work, and they are generating new business, just not maybe in that traditional way, to your point of going out and calling and prospecting and building COIs in the community. Those are all important. But frankly, I feel like the first major hurdle for most folks is, if you as the founder partner are great at prospecting, any amount of time you spend sitting in on a client meeting is, I don't want to say a waste of time, but kind of a waste of your highest and best use of time, where with a little bit of mentoring and training, I say a little bit, it'd probably take a couple of years, you could get somebody to take amazing care of your A and B clients, and that's all they do. And by virtue of doing that one thing all day long, 52 weeks a year, you know, where the founder might be a little cautious early on to turn over the day-to-day servicing of their top clients, after you spend the time mentoring and training and turn that person or team loose, boy, you'll never look back. And all of a sudden, now you're spending all your time prospecting and COIs and still dropping in on client meetings on occasion. That model, all of a sudden, A, looks a lot more scalable. B, for the amount of advisors that tell me that they are a fiduciary to their clients, and not just technically, but that they want what's best for their clients. I hear them say that, but then they spend their time, again, researching technology, doing some client service work, doing a little bit of prospecting because you want to grow the firm. They dabble maybe in marketing and social media. If being a fiduciary and taking great care of your clients is your modus operandi, then I feel like that specialization kind of has to happen to be able to really serve that client and have the highest and best use of everybody's time and effort. Yeah, is that stuff you guys coach too? Do you help them solve for these things?
We do, okay. And it's a big transition, right, yeah, that advisors need to make. And if they want to grow, if they want to build something different, I think there's still a spot for a smaller lifestyle kind of practice, David.
Right.
I don't want to rule out those great people that have done a great job in our industry, making a real difference. My only challenge to the lifestyle practice model would be that if you're acting as a fiduciary, act as a fiduciary. Think about succession, think about continuity planning, think about death or disability. And it isn't your buddy down the block or who you went to sales school with it, Smith Barney or Shearson back in the day. It's got to be somebody that actively knows clients. I had an advisor just last year who got a phone call from a friend of his spouse. His friend had passed away suddenly, and his wife was calling to alert him that he was the successor. They were in different states. They didn't know each other's clients. And she was looking for a check for the value of the business and didn't want to own the business or run the business. I mean, unfortunately, those stories are real. And so you can run a lifestyle practice, but just be mindful as a fiduciary that you're in care of other people's money and their futures, and got to take that really seriously and put that into place. Maybe that's a little call to action for some. But for those that want to make the transition and build something in a more enduring way, the client transitions always go better than you think. If you hire smart and develop the right way, those always go better than you think. If you can build an interdependent team with a clear aspirational vision and a clear set of values that you hire to, with a really good plan to get there, a financial model, then yeah, it goes better than you think. But everything has to be intentional, and you got to be way more opportunistic about building that kind of business. And before we, I know we're going to probably jump here in a hot minute, but yep, I would be remiss if I didn't finish with just one quick comment about the opportunity in this marketplace. If you're today running a wealth advising business and you're, here we are entering 2024 and you're looking into the future, the opportunity for building wealth businesses has never been brighter. I'm watching, as I'm sure you are too, David, the vast amount of investors coming into the space. And they're not coming into this space because this wealth business is bad business. These wealth businesses are great businesses. And as clients build wealth, it's clear they want more advice, not less advice. And so this advice business is a good business to be in. And so owning a wealth management business, if you look at the wealth transfer that's going to occur between now and 2045, it's not only do we live in the greatest country on the planet, but we also are living in one of the most financially successful countries on the planet. We can have a whole lot of debate about that, but the boomers are coming. The boomers are coming. The old Harry Dent days when that generation, right? Remember? Yep. It was like, oh my gosh. And there's probably people listening to this podcast like, Harry Dent, who's that guy? And I just dated myself, but that was going to be the greatest wealth transfer. This next 20 years in wealth transfer land is going to be extraordinary. It's estimated, Tiburon did some research, Chip Roome's organization, it's estimated that some $29 trillion of wealth will be transferred to the Gen Xers. Another $29 trillion will be transferred to the millennial group. The Gen Xers will generate another $33 trillion. And the inheritance, that wealth transfer, 70% of that wealth transfer will be to a woman. The opportunity for expanding services, the opportunity for capturing that money in motion, my goodness, that's only the beginning of the story. If we had more time, we'd get into it. But I just think that if you're the owner of a wealth business, or you're a next generation professional in a wealth business wondering if it's worth taking out a loan to invest in shares of a closely held business, wow, now would be the time to really double down and reinvest back into what the future holds for these wealth businesses.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And frankly, we didn't talk explicitly about the value of these businesses. You mentioned multiples, and where frankly, we don't know where they're necessarily heading, but I got to think long-term, your point on the next generation's interest and willingness to invest in these businesses, literally and figuratively, whether it's a family-owned business, a team, mentor, mentee model, these things are only going to go up in value. And I say that from the lens of just looking at the financials. Like right now, based on the current industry multiples, whether you look at top-line revenue, recurring, non-recurring, earnings, EBITDA, EBOC multiples, bottom line is, for the typical multiples we're seeing today, these businesses still, like net of debt service, taxes, and expenses, generally, most of these deals are throwing off 15, 20% true take-home, like after taxes are paid. I mean, for that reason alone, you're going to see these multiples continue to trend up. And then you layer on top of stuff like the good work that you all do at ClientWise, the industry just generally evolving from that more generalist to the specialist model, creating sustainable growth, which frankly, I mean, 18 years ago when you started out, Ray, like, I don't feel like I ever heard people talking about sustainable. Only thing I heard sustainable was on the investment side.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and bring up the growth opportunity. Mm-hmm. You're talking about it as well. A lot of the data tells us most of these businesses aren't really growing.
Right.
The bulk of the growth has come vis-a-vis an increase in the capital markets. The fee on AUM has increased. And so I think there's a little bit of a wake-up call for many in our industry, especially in the independent and RIA channels. I know Merrill Morgan, UBS, and Wells are addressing this internally with their changes in the comp philosophies there. But I will say on the independent and RIA side, the duly registered, the hybrid folks, and the RIAs, there's a real interesting wake-up call. If you've got that kind of money in motion and you've got that opportunity in front of you, but you're not ready for it, and you don't know really how to put yourself out there, get a brand, build that speciality that you talked about, David, it could be a real ho-hum if you're not ready for it in the next 5 to 7 to 10 years. So this is a great time to be paying attention to your strategy, to your value proposition, to listening to clients, understanding what they want. And you pointed it out, that P&L, tightening up that financial model, tightening up that P&L, really understanding the 5 key benchmarks that matter most when you're sort of structuring something that's profitable, that'll maximize in value. All of that professionalization matters. So great time to be reinvesting and paying attention to that approach.
Well, it's so funny. The simple things like the P&L, we tell folks this all the time, and it actually ends up being very impactful on their business, despite it sounding very innocuous on the front end. There's an old saying from, I think it was Peter Drucker, a great management consultant, often quoted, and it's, what's measured improves. And so we'll tell them. And I know you guys live
right.
That mantra.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. It's really simple, but it is actually true.
What perfect timing as a way to kick the year off, get people thinking. But on the P&L and what's measured improves, we tell folks all the time, just get your P&L and look at it once a quarter. Get your bookkeeper to send you this quarter compared to last quarter, this quarter compared to this quarter last year, and just start studying it, know it. You'll see it consistently. All of a sudden, their profitability magically gets better. Not because they're doing any wholesale overhaul of the P&L, but because what's measured improves. They just start looking at it. So, and they don't, again, you all listening don't have to do this alone. And also, SRG is not going to help you with this. So if you need help with these things, it is incredibly impactful on the valuation of the business and your ability to do succession planning. And while we talk about it a lot, Ray's team at ClientWise can actually help you go do it. So if you need help with that stuff, they are definitely the folks to talk to. So closing question for you, Ray, and I'm going to give you a second to think about it because I didn't prime you for this one, but it's an easy one, I promise.
Okay.
So the question here, I'll give you a second to think about it. Any recommendations on reading, podcasts, stuff for folks listening just to continue to expand their learning and skills?
Well,
And I know you're a student of the game, so they probably don't even need time to think about it. But
well, so it's funny. I'm a big Blinkist fan. I don't know if anybody, do you use Blinkist, David?
No. So I know of it, but no.
Yeah, it's a subscription service, and it's like a Cliff Notes version of a book. So in 17 minutes or so, you can read a book. And my goal is to read or listen to a Blinkist every day. And so far, I've been pretty good for a while. And then what I do is I listen. If I really like the Blinkist, I'm like, ooh, this is a good Blinkist. Then I'll go get the book on Kindle, and then I'll read it or listen to it or both on the Kindle digitally. And man, if I really like it, then I order the book. And I have it here in my library. So P.S., I'll give you a couple of Blinkists and then a couple of Kindle book worth reading. Dan Sullivan is one of my mentors, somebody who I was in strategic coach for 17 years. And I love Dan and Babs and the work they do at Strategic Coach. They're an entrepreneurial coaching training program. And in fact, if you read my book, You've Been Framed, How to Reframe Your Wealth Management Business and Renew Client Relationships, I talk about Dan in the foreword of my book, and he continues to make such a massive difference for entrepreneurs around the world. He and Dr. Ben Hardy teamed up for a number of books. One is called The Gap and the Gain. This is one of those, like, this is one you want on your shelf. And I just leave it on my desk as a gentle reminder. You want to live in the gain, not the gap. Progress over perfection. You can't ever get to the horizon. So create some real solid goals and milestones and celebrate the wins. I think that's a good message as we enter 2024. The other book he and Dr. Ben Hardy wrote is Who, Not How. Title says everything, super easy to read, but I would recommend it strongly. Then I'll give you maybe a couple of others. I could stay here all day. One of my favorites, really good book by Vern Harnish called Scaling Up. And this is something at ClientWise, we're doing a lot of work around scaling right now. We're doing a lot of work around strategy right now. And so these are a couple of books I think that stand out. As far as podcasts go, let me just look real quick in my podcast channels of my latest shows. So, of course, your show, I'd be remiss. I listen to The Daily by The New York Times every day. It is not politically charged. They're just really great stories in 30 minutes or less every day. And I try to catch that on my way into work or away from work. I'm a big fan of anything Michael Kitsis does. I think he single-handedly has got his arms around what's going on in the industry. And so I'm a student of what he's doing. I also enjoy listening to the work by, oh my goodness, I can't believe I just drew a blank. Oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed. It'll come to me.
Scroll through your podcast feed. I'm the same way.
Yeah, it's because I'm listening to these all the time. Let me just go here real quick. One more place. I'm sorry, I'm holding you guys.
No, you're good. I love your comment on the Kitsis and stuff, though, because I listen to him, too. I struggle with him, though, because I think my version of Blinkist is I listen to my audiobooks usually at 1.5 or 2x the speed, and you just get used to it. Well, you get used to it until you go sit down and bump into Michael face-to-face, and he doesn't talk at 2x.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. Okay, so I'm just looking at my feed here. So the Barron's Advisor, silly me, ClientWise has actually been selected as Barron's exclusive advisor coaching partner. That was about 4 years ago.
Oh, no kidding.
Very cool. We've worked with them for so long, and I may be launching something with them in podcast version at some point. But Barron's Advisor is a great listen. I think the other one that I find really good is Mindy Diamond's podcast, which gives I think there are a number of really great case studies that she talks about, and she interviews advisors there. That's really worth listening to. And without boring you to tears, I'll give you one other. My friend Jeff Concepcion does a good job on the Evolving Advisor podcast. And so he's always talking to advisors, anything from tech stack to staffing to valuations and future of the industry. And Jeff, I think, is a real leader at Stratos Wealth and doing a great job. So he's got some great people on as well.
Okay. So that's a good podcast. I know of Jeff and Stratos, obviously. They certainly do a lot in the space that we play in, but I've never listened to the podcast. So it's a good listen.
Yeah, it's a good listen. He dropped the need for the speakers to actually sing at the end, which was the worst part of his podcast. And everybody kind of revolted, I think. So he does great interviews, and they're short and succinct. So you can kind of bang them out and get great takeaways as you listen.
And Ray, how do you not have a podcast, my friend? You've got so much good stuff to espouse.
Well, I appreciate that. I do most of our great work internally for clients. If you're part of the ClientWise network, you're getting all kinds of speaker introductions, and we do all this stuff internally on our platform. But Marie Swift, I was talking to today at Impact Communications, and she's telling me that I need to have a podcast. So David, maybe you'll be our first guest at some point in 2024.
I'd be honored to join you. We could talk shop all day. So I am going to follow up with your team, though. I'm trying to get together again at some point in the first half of this year and just focus on compensation best practices, the stuff I wanted to talk about today. We just ran out of time on transitioning from the advisor to CEO role, how to create sustainable growth. I mean, there's so much good work you guys are doing that I'm going to try to pull it out, tease it out, and then folks who want more can just hire you guys. But in the meantime, if somebody did want to track you guys down, talk with somebody on your team about getting started, where do they go? Website, phone number?
No, thanks for asking. It's just head to clientwise.com. Okay. And in the upper right-hand corner, it says schedule a discovery call. So that's probably the easiest thing to do, or you can just call 800-732-0876.
Brilliant. Well, pleasure as always, Ray. I could spend hours talking with you, and I do plan to, but we'll get some more time on the calendar. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be well. And that concludes another episode of SRG Offscript. We hope you found this episode both interesting and valuable. We encourage you to check out our website at successionresource.com, or of course, connect with us on social for the latest happenings at SRG. If you just can't get enough of SRG Offscript, we invite you to join our monthly Q&A webinar, SRG Offscript Live, where we address your questions sparked by the latest podcast topic. Finally, if you enjoyed today's episode as much as we did recording it, please leave us a review and tell your industry friends about us. Your support helps us continue to bring you the best content possible. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Succession Resource Group. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice. Always seek the advice of an expert with any questions you may have. As always, we at SRG stand ready to help when you're ready.